Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabelle Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work. People who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hi, I'm Rick Cruz, Chief Revenue Officer at Arabelle Advisors, and I'm pleased to welcome you to our From Idea to Impact podcast and to share my conversation with Tony Tijerino, CEO of Hispanic Heritage Foundation. Tony is a true leader, an activist, and as you'll hear many times during this episode, impatient for change in our world and in the Latino community. Tony's also a good friend and one of the best souls I know. As we embark upon Hispanic Heritage Month 2021, Tony's journey in life with his organization and working on some of the most important issues facing us serves as a good touch point for where we are as a country and as a diverse, evolving community. He recounts some painful stories and experiences, offers some powerful advice for the social sector and philanthropy, and most importantly, gives us all reason for hope. And I hope you enjoy our discussion.
Thanks so much for joining today. I'm so excited and looking forward to this conversation all week.
Oh, brother, come on. This is such a treat. It is my highlight to be able to talk to you. And I just appreciate your spirit, your friendship, your support, not just of me, of so many people, Rick. You're a real one.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. You're one of my favorite people. And I appreciate how nice and kind, what a good human being you are, but also, as you like to describe yourself, urgent and impatient. And I think we're going to talk today about some issues that we should all be both urgent and impatient about. So Primo, thank you for being you. I've used these podcasts as a way to really talk about the people behind changes that we're seeing in the world, changes that we need to make, changes in our country. And we've seen a lot in the last few decades, maybe not enough. And we've seen a lot of change in the Latino community. So I just love to get your take on all of that across our time together today. And I want to hear about your experiences, personal ones, your professional ones. There's lots, I think, that folks can learn from what you've been doing. Given that we're going to release this podcast now at the start of Hispanic Heritage Month, I'd love to maybe have you start just talking about your perspective on the origins of this month and the role that Hispanic Heritage Foundation and you've played in that.
Thank you for that. Actually, there's a historical context and that you know is that the Hispanic Heritage Month was created during the Reagan administration as Hispanic Heritage Week was turned into Hispanic Heritage Month. And I think it was 1988. And it was a White House ceremony to commemorate the establishment of Hispanic Heritage Month in this country. And it was September 15th to October 15th, lining up with several Independence Days that were during that time, including Nicaragua, where I'm from, and other Central American countries. And then, of course, Mexico, El Grito is at midnight, which is, I think, officially the 16th. And so that's how Hispanic Heritage Month was created. The Hispanic Heritage Awards were the vehicle to commemorate that establishment. And it was a small White House ceremony. It has grown into a spectacular celebration of culture, accomplishment, vision at the Kennedy Center and on television, which I actually inherited. So we started a lot of the programs that Hispanic Heritage Foundation does, but I inherited the Hispanic Heritage Awards and we're doing them again, the 34th year that we're doing, and it'll be airing on PBS. Nationally on October 8th. And we're very proud of who the honorees are. If you want to ask me
Yeah, I'm going to ask you. I want to acknowledge those 34 years. You know, I think it's such a tremendous opportunity that you and the organization have taken to recognize Latinos who've had a major impact on the country, on our culture, on the world. And the list of people that you've had the opportunity to honor over those years is a who's who of leaders. Sonia Sotomayor, Juno Diaz, Rita Moreno, last year you recognized the nation's essential farm workers. And I know that's a community that's really, it means a lot to you. So I want to hear about that. And as you know, I couldn't let this go without mentioning you recognizing one of my personal faves last year, Bad Bunny. I'm bummed that one wasn't in person, because I've been there in past years and seen just what an amazing, more than anything, what an amazing community comes together to recognize those folks. So yeah, I'd love to hear. Tell me who's on tap for this year.
Well, seeing you dance reggaeton to Bad Bunny would have been worth having a 35th annual Hispanic Heritage Awards next year just for that. So it's been humbling to be around the greatness. And I have to say, thank you for mentioning farm workers, because that is the essence of the program. We want to make sure that we're honoring cultural icons alongside of American stories that need to be told. Farm workers boldly and heroically make it safe for us to be, and our families to be, nourished at home while they're risking themselves, especially during COVID. And I think inspiration comes from everywhere, as I always say. And Monica Ramirez is someone that really highlighted to me the importance of our farm workers. I always appreciated them, but to be able to honor them, in addition to a program we did where we put 1.25 million masks on farm workers during 2020, during COVID, thanks to Monica's influence and work, brought it full circle where we honored them on our television program, along with Bad Bunny and Linda Ronstadt and Jessica Alba, and others that we were able to recognize, along with Selena Gomez. And they were being recognized not simply because they're cultural icons. It's because Selena Gomez was vulnerable and talks about her health issues and mental health issues. And Jessica Alba talks about being a Latina businesswoman, and Bad Bunny talks about supporting the trans community within the reggaeton movement. We also were able to do a tribute to John Lewis as an ally. So this year, on October 8th, we are very excited about the PBS program, and we're going to be able to highlight Carlos Santana, which is huge to me. That's Selma wonderful. Hayek, which is huge to me. Evie Queen, who you're talking about, someone that was in one of the founders of reggaeton as a woman.
Female. Yeah, she is the founding female of the reggaeton movement.
The founding mother of the reggaeton movement. We're also going to be recognizing the Kali Uchis, who I know you're a big fan of and your kids are a big fan of, because we want to make sure that youth is also being served with their role models. They may not connect to Carlos Santana like you and I do, but they certainly will connect to Kali Uchis. We're also honoring Latinas at NASA that were part of putting the rover on Mars and space exploration. Again, it's that mix. We want to make that everyone up there represents a part of the Latino community, and that they're groundbreaking people, that they're pushing the boundaries. And we'll have John Leguizamo hosting it. And we're going to have a tribute to Santana that I can't wait for, because we have Juanes and Black Pumas and others that will be paying tribute to the great Carlos Santana.
Give me two seconds on the Latinas at NASA, because I don't know that. Like, I don't know if folks listen to this will know about who you're calling out, who were so essential to the rover project.
There's going to be three that we want to be able to highlight that are from all over Latin America. And I think also represent what we're capable of, not just on this earth, but beyond this earth. Mm-hmm. So you talk about global change makers. These are universe
interplanetary.
Interplanetary. So we are going beyond. And it's important to think that way too, right? That we're going beyond affecting our own community and affecting our own country and even affecting our own world, that they're going beyond it. And so we are very excited about having your daughter and my daughter look at these role models and having examples of what can be accomplished and impacted.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of unsung heroes, and I think you were getting at that with the essential farm workers, people whose names not everyone will know in the same way they know Selena. And also to think about role models. I know someone you've honored before and that you've worked now closely with is Sister Norma Bimental. Yeah. And I know you were at the border with her recently, and I think you haven't really maybe written or talked about that more recent trip, but tell us about her and tell us about her work and your experience with her.
I haven't written about it because I'm still trying to process what I ended up seeing and what she does every single day that I do once in a while. It is absolutely remarkable the appreciation she has for human life, the responsibility that she holds so dear, to make sure that others are treated with dignity and taken care of. And to be able to work with her now for 7 years, or support her, I should say, has been a privilege. And she's been able to be very gracious with her work. Because I want to say this, Rick, that half the worst feeling you can have as a parent, as somebody in a community, as an American, is to feel helpless. And Sister Norma and others like Maria Gomez, that's at Mary's Center, and Monica Ramirez, they pull you in so that you don't feel helpless. So you feel like you're doing something through their work. And the compassion, the level of compassion that she has is really moving. And that's why I had a hard time even dealing with this, because she's overwhelmed. She's getting 2,000 people a day that she has to take care of in McAllen and the Rio Grande Valley.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong here. So she heads up Catholic Charities. Is that right?
Catholic Charities in Rio Grande Valley.
In Rio Grande Valley. And she's on the border. And yeah, tell us a little bit about what she's been doing these sort of 7 years or beyond and more.
Yeah. So she, once people processed, they're basically going to be sent, they're basically let go, and then at some point have to come back for a trial for their asylum cases, or in other cases, mm-hmm. they're unaccompanied minors. It's so overwhelming that Sister Norma has taken a step up and has welcomed anyone that needs shelter, that needs food, that needs medication, that needs to feel as though they're being welcome. And in the truest sense of faith, that was what hit me so hard when I was on the border, was the purpose of faith and the mission of Sister Norma, to see thousands of people that feel like they belong, feel like somebody cares about them, after not feeling that way. But it's heartbreaking. I mean, there were 2-day-old babies that were being passed around because the mother was passed out because she couldn't, and she was dehydrated and couldn't make milk in order to feed their babies. We had people that hadn't eaten in days. And so when they had a bite of food, they threw it up, because their bodies weren't used to eating at that point. You had the look of just desperation and confusion, and just not knowing what was next.
Yeah. And this was weeks ago. This was literally weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw the situation worse than it was 7 years ago when we had this issue with unaccompanied minors, and then it kind of switches names around. Then it was separated families, and then back to unaccompanied minors, depending on the narrative of the person that's using it for whatever political purpose or everything else. These are lives. You know, I feel as though this has been a humanitarian crisis that's been handled like a political crisis. And Sister Norma's in the middle of this, just simply trying to deal with it as a humanitarian crisis. And so it's a crisis of conscience as well. How do we have children and not see our children in these children? How do we not have empathy in terms of the decision that has to be made by someone in El Salvador or Honduras or or Guatemala or anywhere else, Mexico, and have to make that decision to put your children in harm's way in order to get them to a safer place than they are right now. And then there's climate change, which is another reason people are moving north, especially in places like Nicaragua, where I'm from, that was hit so hard by storms at the end of last year. And you don't have food. And then you're also battling corruption, and you're battling crime, and you're battling horrific violence, the most dangerous places on earth. But all of that being said, when I went to the other side of the border, which is the waiting room to even get to Sister Norma, and Sister Norma took us there because she's now going back and forth. These were thousands of people that were just laying on the concrete that haven't had the opportunity to be processed or to be taken in, and are in literally what's like a waiting room. And they don't even have access. We had set up porta potties, and now the gangs took over the porta potties and are charging for them to even have to go to the bathroom. When somebody came with water, little cups of water, kids lined up as it was the ice cream truck in our neighborhoods just to get a sip of water.
So Tony, given, I mean, what you're describing is even hard for me to comprehend. And we've talked about this before, and it's appreciate it.
I cried for like 15 minutes. I couldn't stop crying, man. I just kept seeing our children in these situations, and us as parents being helpless, but still, thanks to Sister Norma and thanks to others, having some sense of hope, of belonging, of community, that somebody out there cares for you, and that does signify a lot.
Say more about that. I mean, you had the opportunity to meet with these folks, our community members, our global community members who are suffering. Yeah. Obviously, you have a platform to bring awareness. So how does she and others you mentioned make you feel hopeful when I can just sense the helplessness that confronts you when you're there?
Well, you have to have a belief in humanity, and that's where it starts. And I'm sure that drives Sister Norma's work as well. Somewhere there's a Rick Cruz and a Leslie Cruz that are going to care. And you have to hang on to something. Mm-hmm. And it's a hope that the Biden administration will be more compassionate. It's a hope that, and thoughtful. It's a hope that members of Congress are going to somehow have that connection to these families the way they do their own families. It's a hope that climate change is going to get better and not displace people. Despite the negativity out there, you cling to that hope, and Sister Norma and others bring you that sense of hope. But for right now, it's triage. And it's action.
Yeah. For Arabella, who works with philanthropists and change makers on a lot of issues. And then also for our broader Latino community, as we go into Hispanic Heritage Month, like, what do we need to know? What can we be doing? How can we be helping? You're on the front. You've been on the front lines again. Yeah. At different moments.
Well, there's several stages to it, and one is what's happening in the home countries. So we're actually working with Catholic Relief Services and others in Panama to teach coding and other skills that youth will need. Instead of saying just stay home, we need to give people a reason to stay home. And so what we're trying to do is, through workforce development and personal development, trying to provide those skills, especially in agriculture, whatever it is that they have the best chance to be able to hash out a career and create a better lives for themselves and their families. So one thing's in the home country. Then it's during the journey to make sure that people are safe. I mean, at one point, 6 out of 10 of these little girls that look like our girls are being sexually assaulted. And that's, you know, I'll never forget going down to see Sister, and I asked, what do you need? And part of the inventory was rape kits. We want to be able to talk about that journey to make it safer. And the longer they stay in some of the other countries, the more difficult it is before they get to that green lady holding up that lamp, right, that says, you know, that talks about the lamp by the golden door. And we have to think about the importance of our immigrant and migrant communities, you know, and the value that is provided. And then, of course, it's what's happening at the border. That's lawyers, that's, you know, legal support, that's health support, that's social workers, the mental health that you're dealing with somebody that's had to leave their parents and suddenly is in a strange land. And you have so much farther to go once you actually get to our borders. You think you've accomplished your trip, and you haven't. You have a lot farther to go. So and then once you're there, and even if you get past that, we still have to deal with these communities when they come into where we live. And mm-hmm. where I live and you live in the greater Washington area is a hotspot for Central Americans. And so this is going to be a place where we're going to get a lot of Central Americans. There are pockets all over the country where we have to welcome them, where we have to support. And look, one of the families that I talked to, I have a picture in my office, actually, because I got the little girl to smile because I showed her a video. I FaceTimed her with my daughter, who had given me a toy to give to one of the little girls. I get emotional just thinking about it. And the little girl smiled for the first time. The little boy wasn't having it. He wasn't smiling. And the mom was there and told me that she had come home from picking up these kids from school and was coming home to her husband and her toddler and her mother that were all living in the house. And the house was on fire. It had been burnt because they couldn't pay, you know, the extortion money, the impuestos, you know. And so they burned her toddler, her husband, and her mother. She turned around and just started walking with the two kids that she had left. And so here she was at Sister Norma's, and as I'm asking her what's next for her, she said, Señor, she couldn't even pronounce the word Tennessee, which was where she was heading. And she said, is it cold there? How do you pronounce it? I gave her some money. I gave her my phone number. She never called. Mm-hmm. And you know, I tried to talk to her and give her comfort, which is something everyone can give. We may not have money to give.
Right.
We may not have a home to give, but we all have comfort to give. And help change that narrative and be able to say that, what would you have done if you came home and your house is on fire with your husband, your toddler, and your mother in it, and you're holding two kids that you just brought home from school, and you're going to turn around now and go to safety, which is what we all would do. But that's the thing in Tennessee, what's set up to welcome them? And that's the other thing that we have to depend on. Some of these amazing community centers and faith-based groups, as well as, you know, when I'm telling you the collective effort, when we went down there recently and we've gone down there, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, African-American groups, Asian groups, all are coming together to support this effort, that's how it has to be. We have to continue to talk about the shared experience. You know, we're all strangers at some point in some land, and we have a responsibility to look at this being this family's turn. And you can't look at it as a lump sum. You can't say 70,000 crossed this month or million have crossed since October. That feeds into that notion that, you know, millions is a number, one is a tragedy. We have to look at it as that one family, that is that mother with her two children that are trying to get to Tennessee and some sort of safety.
Yeah. And that contextualizes it in a way that this is unfinished business. I think sometimes, you know, we've been talking about this issue for so many years now, and the fact that literally weeks ago you were confronted with something that, as you said, we could have described 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And in some ways it's getting worse. Tony, the theme of justice is such a through line across so much of what you do, whether it's with youth, whether it's with computer science, whether it's with the work at the border. And I know you hate talking about your own experience, but our passions and our vocations come from someplace. When you're doing this work, what does it connect to from your own personal experience? And I don't want to exceptionalize it because I know you hate that. I know you hate that, but it's informative and it's important.
Yeah, I it does come from somewhere, and I just don't want to overdramatize it because there's others that have been through a far worse journey. Yeah. In terms of who I was just talking about, that woman and her two children. But there was a time, I came over here when I was six from Nicaragua, and it that was difficult. And that's that we were on a plane and my dad had a job that he came to, and just simply not knowing the language and, you know, being bullied and having to adjust to a different life, was difficult enough. But now, after civil war in Nicaragua and we were in Nicaragua and all of a sudden I was sent back to the United States for a second time. And this time I had to stay at friends' houses. Sometimes, stayed in a car, and got through high school that way. And wasn't even like I was back here in Washington, D.C. I was in a rural part of the Midwest where I was sent, because there was an aunt there, and the reunification process doesn't always work. They're wonderful people, but it just didn't work out in terms of suddenly two teenage boys are at your doorstep. And that's a heavy thing. But there were also benefits to it. I spoke the language. My brother and I both spoke the language. We knew how to get around. We knew that ultimately we weren't going to be abandoned and we were going to be taken care of. But we didn't have our papers. We were dealing with being made fun of a different kind of bullying than when I was 6 years old. This was a grown gym teacher that was saying after showers, saying, "Hey, you missed a spot on your back. It looks like your back's still wet," and calling me a wet back. And every time I would walk into a room, I smell beans. And it's funny, the kids stopped that kind of talk when they heard grownups doing it to us. And then I remember going on a date with this girl where she said, "Hey, listen, I think you can get away with it." And I said, "Get away with what?" And she said, I think we can get away with telling my parents that you're Italian." And it was that moment when I didn't necessarily have tons of Latin pride. I had bits of it with Roberto Clemente or Roberto Duran, and others. But all of a sudden, it really kind of redefined me as I was dealing with this experience. But it also informed me in terms of living in the Midwest in a rural area where we were definitely the other. And how does that help me in what later would become my advocacy? Not having a home for a while until this wonderful family took us in my senior year and I was dating their daughter, and they took us in and we had some sort of normalcy.
They knew you were an Italian.
They knew I wasn't Italian. And they accepted us anyway. But all of that does inform you. And my home has been open, and I give credit to my wife and children as well, that we have opened my home to, at this point, probably thousands of kids over the last 20 years that will have an internship in Washington, D.C., unpaid, at on the Hill or at the White House, and have no place to stay. So those will go to the kids that can afford some place to stay or are from the area. So they would stay in our basement, sometimes three and four of them. And they're now all grown up now and have actually helped us as a family, which is always interesting when that goes full circle. But that's why our home is always open. That's why my heart is always open. And that's why I'm such a fierce advocate on behalf of the disenfranchised and those being put upon and treated as though they don't belong. So it absolutely informs it. I hate bullies more than anything. And this is the way of making sure that somebody else isn't bullied now that I have a position that can help. But that being said, the impatience thing, we have got to be more impatient with injustice of all kinds, including in our own community.
Yeah, you speak so eloquently about this, and you mentioned honoring John Lewis last year at the awards. And I know you feel strongly about the role that our very diverse Latino community needs to play on racial justice. So I'd like you to sort of say, I think you were going there. I'd like you to say some more about that, about some of the things we need to do in our own world.
Yeah, thank you, Rick, because we have a blueprint as to what not to do. Yet we turn around and do it. As a community, we're racist, we're homophobic, we're sexist, we're Islamophobic, we're anti-Semitic. Somebody has a limp, we call him el renco, as if it's a term of endearment. It's a horrible thing to say about somebody that's disabled. And so we body shame all day long. I mean, that becomes your nickname, even after you've lost weight. It is something that plagues our community, and we somehow have said that it's cultural and somehow endearing to call people these names. And I don't accept it. And our advocacy starts at our kitchen tables with our own families, where we say, no, I don't like that term. And then it goes into when we're behind closed doors. And I had somebody say the other day at a very high level meeting of Latino leadership that were saying things that I felt were somehow pitting us against other communities and racial groups. And you can't be, you can't say you're an ally without being a real ally. To be an ally doesn't mean that you compare your suffering to someone else. It means that you're an ally.
You're an ally. Yep.
And you build that trust and build that relationship to where they're an ally to you. This has to stop, this competitiveness within our groups. And I was in this meeting and somebody said something to that effect about the Asian and Black community and how we're being left behind. And I was just like, I don't like that talk. And they said, well, this is supposed to be a safe place for us to have these conversations. And I said, well, it's not safe if I'm here. So stop inviting me if you want to have closed meetings to talk about this. That we can make a great case for why we need more advertising money, more philanthropic money, more representation at the board level, in Hollywood, in tech, in nonprofit space, across the board. In education, we're almost one out of four students, but we're only 6% of teachers, and less than 1% is male teacher, Latino teacher. So we have a million different ways to make a case. It does not have to be, well, the Black community got this or the Asian community got this. And so this is where I think it's really important for us to also represent everyone that isn't in that room. You hear something sexist, you say it. You can say it more politely at first and not so politely the third time. But I think we owe it to ourselves and whoever they're talking about to let someone know that I'm not comfortable with this conversation, therefore you shouldn't be comfortable having it in front of me. And we have to continue to do that. And that includes in uncomfortable situations with our benefactors, with our colleagues sitting on a board. I sit on a whole bunch of boards. I'm pretty much the only Latino on that board. I have a responsibility to represent everyone that isn't in that room, whether they're Latino or not. So I think there's a lot of work to do there, and it starts with us as a community. And then, of course, it goes out. And you have to be, and if you want to be an activist, you pay attention to the first three words of that term, and it's to act. And so when I hear people saying, preaching patience, and talking about long-term plans on dealing with an issue and everything, and I'm just like, no. That's not going to cut it for you.
I know.
That's no, and we have to have a level of, I mean, those are when somebody says, oh, what are your great things that you, and I was just like, look, I'm naive. That's a good thing, because it makes you try things that you don't normally going to try, because you think you're naive enough to think that the change can happen. You have to be audacious. You know, you have to be able to take these things on. You have to be collaborative, which means have the idea, do all the work, and be willing to give all the credit. And then make someone feel good about getting the credit. Otherwise, you shouldn't be in this game. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be in the advocacy game. And then, of course, being impetuous is so critical to any activist. You know, we have to be able to drive action. And I think that it's, there are little elements of this. And certainly, we have to be measurable.
I was going to ask you what your view on leadership is, and I think you just actually distilled it in advance of the question. And I know you as you said, you work, youth is such a huge part of the work that you do, the Youth Leadership Awards, the tens of thousands of students that your organization is partnering with others to teach coding, Latino, young Latino, oftentimes at risk, poor kids who are getting access to coding. There's so much that you're doing. What else would you say about the leadership that you teach to youth, you teach to your family, that you work, the leadership that you espouse with your staff?
All right. So there are a couple things here on leadership. Number one, leading followers is boring. Leading leaders is where it's at. Two, I don't lead shit. I get led. I get led by my community. I get led by you. I get led by youth. And I'd rather get advice from a 16-year-old than a 60-year-old any day. And I'm closing in on 60. So I just want to talk about where the upside of leadership is. And also the many manifestations of leadership. To lead is to serve. To serve is that you're in a position of privilege. I don't care if you're picking up a piece of paper in the park. You're in a position of privilege that you can bend over, pick that piece of paper up, and throw it into a garbage can. That's all leadership. And that's all having an impact. When we, by the way, we're teaching 100,000 kids how to code. thanks to our many partners, and thanks to, you know, being able to count on our own community, we've built an ecosystem that is doing all of that teaching. The other thing is, that we've been able to lift, our network is now like 250,000 wow. 15 to 40 year olds. And they're all leaders. So then you multiply that impact. When people say one leader at a time, I'm like, one leader to lead 10,000, you know? And think about, thanks to technology, a 15 year old can reach more people than Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Cesar Chavez could in their iconic lifetimes combined in a split second if they have access to the internet, if they have access to a device. That's power. So where are you going to invest? In the greatest potential for impact in history? History is right now. To be able to create a movement by using social media, having their value system projected on their own terms. That's what gives me the optimism. But you have to be able to get out of their way once you're supporting our role. When people try to be relevant at my age, I'm like, you're missing the boat. You want to be relevant? You do it through those that you can support. Mm-hmm. And support isn't heavy-handed, by the way. A lot of times it's knowing when to get out of the way. After encouragement is important. Right. Helping them connect and build relationships is important. Access to resources is important. But they've got the vision. Having someone believe in them. And throughout my whole life, brother, the two things that have driven me are somebody believing in me and somebody not believing in me. They both work just as well for me in terms of motivating me. I'd rather have the first one, but they both work just as well. One doesn't work any better than the other, but we have to be able to motivate and then at some point get out of the way and continue to support from afar. And from what I've seen, we just did this Loft Institute that we just lifted with Trinity University and my man Juan Sepulveda. It's absolutely remarkable the work that he's actually leading.
This is your youth leadership.
Institute that we just lifted. Are you ready for this? I'm gonna give it to you in really quick nutshell because it's remarkable. Over 30,000 applicants, and these are kids that are more like you than like me. I wouldn't be able to apply for my own thing. So 30,000 applicants from all 50 states, plus Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., get narrowed down to 10 cohorts of 30 in different sectors. So sustainability, tech, engineering, social justice, healthcare, media and entertainment, entrepreneurship, education. And so all of these become ways for others to tap into a talent pool, as well as for us to be able to move them forward. Now, here's what's brilliant about Juan. So they, over the summer, between their senior year of high school and their freshman year of college, wrangling them is not an easy thing. There's 4 3-hour sessions, which is remarkable. That's 120 hours or something of this. What was incredible was that first session, the genius of Juan, was all about building social capital. We just worked on identity.
And so
the 10 different cohorts of 30, all they did was talk about the 10 lenses that they see themselves through and then discussed it with everyone else to get to know them. This is the first part of a leadership training. And I'm telling you, some kids were scratching their heads going, when are we going to learn about leadership? That's the brilliance of Juan, which is we need to make sure that they know each other, because at some point there's a little Antonio Tijerino that needs to know a Rick Cruz and needs to be connected to each other. And think about the 10 lenses of our identities, our kids' identities. Think about your identity. Peruvian, grew up in the Bronx, went to Yale, works in non-Latino areas, but yet it's a strong part of your identity because I know you. That's you. It's complex. Mm-hmm. Now, what's it going to be like for your kids? What's it like for my kids that are half Filipino, half Latino, and I think actually part Russian? And what is their identity? You know, it's going to be somehow influenced by me, but it's going to be more influenced by the music they listen to, by their friends, by the neighborhood that they grew up in. So it's a fascinating thing. Then intersectionality. I can tell you one thing: of the 300 kids, 1/3 of them do not identify as being straight. So there's a beauty in that. This is our richness, right? 1 out of 5 are Afro-Latino, and our entire community identifies as Afro-Latino. There's a beauty in that. We look like everybody. Right. Everybody looks like us. I have cousins.
That's a power. That's a challenge. It is also a challenge as we think about political power, as we think about bringing the community together. And I love your lens on leadership, which is we need to take our leadership cues from this group coming up, because they're very powerful. They have a sort of different expectations of what life should look like. Deeply values oriented, but they look very different than our generation. And that could either be exciting or frightening. It definitely is challenging, but I think we should definitely look at it as exciting.
A minute ago, I was just talking about how we need to tell our own stories, own our own narrative. We define ourselves, but that definition needs to be broader. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what comes with this group. You know, it's not just millennials, it's Generation Z, Generation Next, like my daughter and my son and my other daughter. they're going to define us in a completely different way than millennials defined us. And they're going to define as they defined us in a different way than right. Generation X or baby boomers. And so we have to continue to evolve based on where youth takes us. So when you ask me my leadership style, it's to follow.
Yeah, that's a great place to sort of start closing us out. And oh gosh, Tony, we could talk as we have before for hours and hours, and this would be a very long episode, but maybe I'll close on what you shared, which is that you're going to be recognized by Hispanics in philanthropy for your work and for the organization's work. And you know, as you're thinking about addressing that group, what's your message, and how should we close out today's conversation with that message?
Well, first of all, I am so overrated when it comes to some of these recognitions. It's a reflection on everyone that I am able to benefit from, including you. And people should know who you are and the impact that you have individually on so many, not just on me, but on kids that you have mentored, that I've had the confidence and the trust in you to support. And you've done that. Quietly, nobody around.
If you're overrated, I am way overrated, my brother. So, no, what is that message? What is that message you're gonna land as you're talking to that group, as you're talking to philanthropy more generally?
More impatience with your philanthropy. A lot of times with people in philanthropy and academics and a lot of other areas. It's a very long-term view, and nothing should be in lieu of a long-term view. But there is an immediacy. There are people that are suffering right now, and we should not be patient with a child being torn from their parents' arms. We should not be patient with racial injustice. That's been, how much more patient are you supposed to be? It's been 400 years. We should not be patient with homophobia in any sense. We should not be patient with sexism, continued sexism that we hear about every single day in the news, and harassment of women and others. We should absolutely, and the disabled, and look, the Native American community, as bad as everyone else feels that they're being treated, there's a group that is truly disenfranchised that needs to be lifted with honor, because they certainly have a remarkable story to tell that we all draw from. And so impatience is what I would say. And also being able to be more collaborative and breaking down some of the structure of how you provide funding. You have to make it more democratized. Everyone should have access based on their impact, on their vision and meritocracy. And the last thing that I would say to them is to also invest. The way we're trying to address diversity in technology and Hollywood and in business and other areas, there's an area that it's lacking. And you've been in this area, which is in the nonprofit space. We need to make sure that nonprofit leaders reflect the communities that they're serving as much as possible. And that is with great gratefulness to people that are serving because in their heart, they're trying to help communities, but we do need that representation. I was supportive of my wife when she had three of my children. I don't know what it's like to give birth, no matter how much I try to empathize, no matter how much I try to support, and no matter how much I was physically there, I don't know what that's like. And so it's the same thing with a lot of our communities. We need more Latinos running nonprofits. We need more African Americans. We need more Asians. We need more Native Americans. We need more representation in the nonprofit space. And the philanthropic community can have a lot to say in guiding some of this, as well as making sure that we're not pitted against each other as nonprofits. We're competing for the same funds, and we're not pitted against other races and ethnic groups as we're going after the same funding. That comes, that can be driven by the philanthropic community. And I want to see the philanthropic community take a bigger role in making sure that we're all rowing in the same direction at the same timing, again, with more impatience.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.